From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, a strong cocktail of mercury, lead, and arsenic, we explore the history of poison. John Emsley is a chemist and popular science writer. His new book, The Elements of Murder, is about intentional and accidental uses of lethal compounds through the ages. He'll present evidence that Beethoven and Napoleon may have been poisoned, and he'll explain why certain Victorian wallpaper was beautiful but lethal. Also, why all the hippies met on South Street. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles a Philadelphia record label that turned out shallow but memorable hits in the late 50s and early 60s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. For centuries, human beings have been using deadly elements like mercury, lead, and arsenic, and all too often poisoning themselves or others through accident, ignorance, environmental contamination, and murder. My guest, science writer John Emsley, chronicles the use of nature's deadliest substances for medicine, cosmetics, industry, and homicide. His new book is called The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. Emsley says a surprising number of well-known historical figures, including kings and composers, may have actually been poisoned. And he's discovered that some of history's most prolific serial killers used lethal powders or potions as their weapons of choice. John Emsley spent 20 years as a researcher and lecturer in chemistry at London University before leaving to become a popular science writer. He's written 5 books and was awarded the Science Book Prize in 1995 for his Consumer's Good Chemical Guide. Well, John Emsley, welcome to Fresh Air.
Very nice to be here.
You've been immersed in poison, so to speak, in writing this book and have uncovered just some fascinating historical details about ways in which very well-known historical figures have been poisoned either accidentally or homicidally. You tell us that the English king, Charles II, died at the age of 54, apparently due to acute mercury poisoning, which occurred at the king's chemistry lab. What on earth was a 17th century English king doing in a chemistry lab?
Well, he was trying a little bit of alchemy. I mean, King Charles II, who was the king who came after our Commonwealth period, our Republic, was always short of money because he was endlessly in conflict with the Parliament because the Parliament were basically Commonwealth people. And, of course, he turned to Louis XIV of France to help him out with subsidies, but even those weren't enough. And so, of course, he set up a small lab, hoping to be able to convert base metals like lead into gold. And, of course, at that time, it was thought that that would be possible.
I mean, that was the so-called science of alchemy, right?
Yes. I mean, he was trying to become an alchemist. Now, there were people at the time, and we now know, of course, from our records, that these were basically con men who would go around Europe showing how it was possible to convert these base metals into gold, but of course it was all trickery. But people like Charles II were fooled by this. I mean, quite eminent people were also trying it. Isaac Newton, the great scientist, also did a lot of alchemical experiments. But what they didn't know, of course, was that the mercury that they were using, when they boiled this off to try and reclaim whatever gold was there, they breathed that mercury vapour in, and of course it was deadly. And this is what Charles II did in his laboratory in the palace at Westminster. The day after, he was taken very ill. 3 days later, he was dead.
You know, one of the interesting things that you tell us in this book is that each of these poisons reacts with the body differently. And one thing about mercury is that you can breathe in intense doses of it, and it won't, in fact, give you immediate respiratory symptoms, but goes to your brain and wreaks havoc.
Well, this is the problem with mercury, and I mean, this is why it's been so insidious over the years, because, you know, a lot of mercury was used in lots of industries, Dave, as you probably know. I mean, the hat industry, for example, they were always exposed to mercury, and of course this phrase, mad as a hatter, reflects the symptoms that they often showed. You became paranoid, you became talkative, you became secretive, your hands were shaking all the time, you became very quarrelsome. And these symptoms, we now know, were due to the fact that some mercury can actually penetrate into the brain, and there, of course, it begins to affect your mental behaviour.
What did hatters use mercury for?
Well, most hats were made of felt, and felt was made from very short fur, like rabbit fur and beaver fur. And in order to get that fur to mat together and form a strong bond, you treated it with a compound called mercury nitrate. And once you treated it with that, then, of course, it did form a proper felt, and then you can manipulate that felt, you could iron it, you could shape it into whatever shape you want it for a hat. But all the time, of course, you were working with it, it was giving off small amounts of mercury, and the dust in the atmosphere of the workshop would be heavy with mercury, and you'd be breathing this in. And over a period of time, you would then become, you know, mad as a hatter. People weren't totally disabled by this, but they were always known to behave very eccentrically. I mean, America, it was known as Danbury Shakes, because Danbury was the town, I think, where most hats were made in America at the time.
Now, there have also been some cases of mass mercury poisoning, and one of the most famous involved the Japanese fishing village in Minamata Bay, if I've got the name right, in the 50s, where there was a chemical plant that nearby that used mercury. Now, how did that mercury poisoning first reveal itself?
Well, that's a very different sort of mercury poisoning, Dave, because there they were releasing accidentally in the wastewater from the plant. They weren't deliberately putting mercury into the wastewater, but it was going into the bay, and of course it was settling into the sediment at the bottom of the bay. And we now know that there are microbes that live in sediment that can add a methyl group, as it's called, it's a carbon compound, add a methyl group to mercury. And once you've done that, it becomes much more soluble. And of course, then it got into the food chain. And of course, people around Minamata, and especially people in that area of Japan, their major protein source is fish. So of course, their diet was slowly poisoning them. And of course, it got to quite critical proportions when there were hundreds of people being affected. And what was perhaps saddest about this was it could pass the, not only could methyl mercury pass into the brain, but it could pass through the placenta into a fetus. And so you were getting an awful lot of deformed babies being born. Of course, people didn't understand what was going on. Mercury wasn't suspected. I mean, mercury had never sort of behaved like this before. But eventually, it was traced to mercury. And of course, once you knew it was that, then of course you could stop people eating fish from the bay. And then, of course, the incidence of the disease disappeared. But it took the people who were affected something like 20 years to get compensation for the terrible calamity that had happened to them.
One of the fascinating things about that story was that the problem revealed itself initially through birds, the behavior of birds and cats.
Well, this is because it was known, for example, that some of the seagulls around the bay, of course, they live off seafood. They were doing peculiar things. Some of them were just diving in, almost like suicidal kamikaze, into the sea and killing themselves. And cats were running around in circles, apparently mad. And again, people didn't recognize that this was coming from. They thought that it was just some animal disease that was happening. They didn't realise, of course, these were being affected by the methyl mercury because they, of course, meet smaller doses of this before they display the same sort of symptoms. And then, of course, eventually it began to appear in humans and gradually it built up until something had to clearly be done. And then a research was done and it was realised that it was methyl mercury from the sediment in the bay.
Well, let's talk about arsenic. It's all around us and has been used for centuries. You note that chickens fed on an arsenic-free diet don't really develop properly, that it's actually beneficial to mammals in the right dosage.
Well, yes, this is, again, one of those cases where I don't think it's been absolutely proven that arsenic is essential to humans. But certainly when tests were carried out on chickens and they were fed an absolutely arsenic-free diet, their bones didn't develop properly, and then when arsenic was introduced in small amounts into their food, then they did begin to develop properly. Now, we still don't know that would be the same for humans. Of course, we can never do that sort of experiment with humans. All we can say is that perhaps a little bit of arsenic is necessary, and we all know we've got some arsenic in our body because it comes along the food chain. It's a perfectly natural component of food. But, of course, our body can generally get rid of it fairly easily. It doesn't build up, and we might just retain the small amount that for some reason we need, although, as I say, we don't yet know why we need it.
Where do human beings get arsenic? In other words, when it's used as a chemical compound, it's not mined, obviously. Where does it come from?
Well, no, it isn't mined. I mean, funnily enough, it used to be mined accidentally. I mean, at one time, you're going back now something like 150 years, there were copper mines in the south of England, and the spoil heaps, the part that they didn't want, arsenic came along with the copper. They just used to put into slag heaps. And eventually, of course, when arsenic was in great demand because it was this beautiful green pigment called Scheele's green, an emerald green, then, of course, they began to rework these great slag heaps for the arsenic they contained. So it's always been a sort of a byproduct of other minerals, Dave. It's never mined for itself.
Okay.
It was needed on a large scale because it not only as a pigment, it was widely used in medicines. There was a very popular medicine throughout the 19th century called Dr. Fowler's solution. And this was a tonic. And it was something you gave to people who were convalescing from illness. And you gave them the small amounts. It was potassium arsenite, and it was dissolved in water. You gave people a few drops of this. And, of course, it does have a slightly temporarily beneficial effect on your metabolism. It speeds it up, so you begin to feel a bit better. And quite famous people like Charles Dickens, the author, used to go into his local pharmacist and have a few drops of Fowler's solution several times a week because he was regarding it as a tonic, as so many people did.
Were they also poisoning themselves while they were taking it?
Not really, because the sort of dose you're getting, you're talking about milligram doses, and in order to kill someone, you need to give them something like 250 milligrams. And the sort of doses they were getting were perhaps 1 or 2 milligrams, just enough to give you a little bit of a boost, but not enough to put your life at risk. And anyway, the body quite easily gets rid of arsenic. It's one of those elements that it doesn't really build up in the body. And you know, this is why sometimes there are peculiar murder cases where the victim, who finally was analysed, their remains were analysed, had very little arsenic in them, and yet we know from what happened that they were actually poisoned with it because they survived long enough to get rid of most of it before they died.
Right. Now, describe what happens when you ingest a lethal dose of arsenic. How does the body react?
Well, it depends, of course, how quickly it reacts on what, whether you're having it with a meal or you're just taking it on an empty stomach. If you take it on an empty stomach, it gets very quickly into the bloodstream, and then, of course, it begins to screw up all sorts of organs around the body. And you're very quickly vomiting, you're very quickly, your gut is trying to get rid of it, so you've terrible diarrhea, and that becomes almost uncontrollable. You've got terrible thirst because your body wants more water to try and get rid of it, but the more you drink, the worse your vomiting gets. And you have a terrible few hours, and then eventually, perhaps after 8 hours, you do die. So it is quite a nasty thing to be given.
Now, I was surprised to read in your book that there were some cases of people who actually eat arsenic for their health.
Well, this again was, it was one of the, what you might call, urban myths of the 19th century. There was this rumour that there were groups of peasants in middle Europe who actually used arsenic, the white arsenic, it's arsenic oxide, used it almost like we would use salt. In other words, for their breakfast, they sprinkled it over everything. And people said, oh, of course, that can't possibly be true. You can't treat arsenic like that. But then at a conference, I think about 1850, two of the peasants who did this, who were arsenic eaters, were produced at the conference, and in front of a large audience, they ate twice the fatal dose of arsenic. They had 500 milligrams of arsenic. The following day, they reappeared, still in perfectly good health. Their urine had been collected and analysed, and they were discharging massive amounts of arsenic through their urine, but it wasn't affecting them. In other words, they built up a sort of immunity to arsenic by slowly building up the dose and using it regularly.
My guest is John Emsley. His new book is The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with chemist and science writer John Emsley. His new book is called The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. Now, arsenic, of course, created this beautiful green dye, which was used a lot in wallpaper, which created problems for wealthy citizens of Europe, right?
Oh, yes, very indeed. And some quite famous people were affected by it. I mean, Napoleon is supposed to be the person who was, if anybody was poisoned with it, was poisoned with his wallpaper. Now, I deal with this in the book. I'm not absolutely certain it's a proven case because, rather strangely, we do know exactly what was on the walls of the bedroom where Napoleon died. There was a broadcast several years ago about this when the theory was first put forward that the arsenic on his wallpaper had become volatile and got into the room, and there he breathed it in and been poisoned with it. And the person doing the broadcast actually said, well, of course, we can never know what the wallpaper was like on Napoleon's room. But one of the listeners actually wrote in and said, yes, her great-great-grandfather had actually visited his bedroom shortly after his death and torn a piece of wallpaper off the wall and preserved it. And, of course, that went off for analysis, and there indeed was arsenic in the wallpaper. So there's a little bit of proof, but I don't think it's a serious thing. I think he died of a perforated ulcer, which is what the post-mortem actually said. But, of course, if you want a conspiracy theory, then, of course, heavily greened wallpaper would not help him.
But it's believed that a lot of people in the European aristocracy may have suffered from some level of arsenic poisoning from this wallpaper?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, there were the Italian government asked chemist Gozio to investigate why people were chronically sick in certain houses. And he discovered that if you put a little bit of the pigment that was used on the wallpaper with flour paste and wet it, then you've got an awful smell coming off it, which he said was rather like mice. And we know it wasn't, because he wasn't in a position to analyse the vapour that was coming off. That was done about, 30 years later, when three children died in a bedroom in Britain. And a professor from Leeds University was asked to look at this, and he was able to prove that what was coming off was something called trimethyl arsine, a very dangerous vapour. And, of course, we now know that this was probably present in lots of bedrooms. And, of course, this would explain why people who became ill and then took to their bed were chronically ill for months and sometimes for years, because they were endlessly being poisoned with small amounts of arsenic.
Well, arsenic has been useful not only in coloring wallpaper, it's been useful in killing people, that is to say, in plotting murders. Why is arsenic trioxide an effective homicidal poison?
Because the thing is, it produces a set of symptoms which until, well, last century, of course, it was possible to distinguish between arsenic poisoning and cholera, for example. Now, in the 19th century and years before, cholera was quite a common illness. And the symptoms you get with arsenic, of course, vomiting and diarrhea, are those symptoms that you get with cholera. So it wasn't possible, most doctors, when they were treating a patient, would not assume that their patient had been poisoned with arsenic. They would assume their patient had drunk contaminated water and had gone down with cholera. So it was moderately easy to disguise the fact that you poisoned somebody. Nowadays, of course, there's no risk at all because immediately a blood sample would show that the level of arsenic in that person's blood was far too high. And so I don't think the risks are anything like what they used to be. And of course, as you probably know, you can't get these materials. Once of a day, you could go into most pharmacies and buy arsenic, provided you signed the poison register and provided you could get a good reason for wanting it, like getting rid of vermin or something like that. Nowadays, of course, you wouldn't be able to do it anyway. Only a few people could get contact with arsenic, and I suspect, even those are very restricted now.
You profile several 19th century serial killers for whom arsenic was their weapon of choice. What was one of the most compelling stories to you?
Well, the best one of all is Florence Maybrick. This is a classical one. The reason why she was quite young. She was an American. She was quite young. She met this man, James Maybrick. Her mother was taking her to Europe to do a tour when she was 19. She met this rather rich man. He was old enough to be her father. But they fell in love, and nevertheless they got married. Because he, as I say, he was old enough to be her father, and after 10 years, of course, she perhaps found a young man, Briley, who took her fancy. They went off to London for a dirty weekend. They lived in Liverpool. And then, of course, she began to realise she wanted rid of her husband. But in those days, of course, divorce was out of the question. And so she resorted to poison. But she wasn't a very good poisoner. This is why it was a very debatable case at the time. When her husband died, he'd very little arsenic in his body. And of course, what she'd been doing, buying arsenic in various guises, we now know when you reanalyse the thing, and we know from our position as to what the symptoms would be, how she did it, and it's perfectly good. Now, on top of the layer of that, of course, is a theory that was advanced about 10 years ago that the man she murdered was actually Jack the Ripper. Because his diary turned up, or his supposed diary turned up, and it's been authenticated of the time, which was in the 1880s. It's that type of paper, it's that type of ink. But was it a forgery? We don't know. So it's a layer upon layer of murder cases, this. And that's why it's my favourite, certainly. I mean, I'm pretty sure she did it. But, there are lots of books being written about how she didn't get a fair trial because of the times, the male jury was against the idea of her poisoning her husband and so on. So there are layers of reading you can read into this particular murder case, but it's certainly my favourite one.
In terms of how she actually did her husband in, was she the one that would go and buy flypaper that was designed to catch flies and then soak it, and then the servants would observe her, the mistress of the house, strangely soaking flypaper in water for some purpose?
Well, she bought what was called black arsenic in those days. In order that people couldn't poison people, what they did was they took white arsenic, which was used, and they put mixed soot with it. Now, she found that she could boil this in water and filter it through a silk handkerchief and get rid of most of the soot. So she had a solution of quite toxic arsenic. She used that for some time, but it didn't work because she didn't know how much she needed, and she always gave him too little. So then she turned to these fly papers. Now, in Victorian times, what you bought was a fly paper, and it was a bit like blotting paper or filter paper. And you put it on a saucer or a plate, and you wet it. And the water did was dissolve out sugar and arsenic from the fly paper. And, of course, the fly would go onto it. It wouldn't detect the arsenic. It would detect the sugar. Of course, it would then sample it, and then it would kill it. But, of course, if you added enough water, you then got a deadly solution, sweet solution of arsenic, which you could then use for poisoning people, and a lot of poisons did this. That didn't work for her, so she went back to more arsenic. And so when you look at it, I shouldn't say this, but it is quite an amusing murder case. And, of course, she wasn't hanged. She was found guilty, but her sentence was commuted, and she then had to serve it out. Apparently, because Queen Victoria had taken against her, Queen Victoria had followed the cases in the newspapers, And when there was this enormous agitation, especially from America, even presidents of the time wrote in support of giving her early release. Queen Victoria always said no. She was convinced she'd done it. And, of course, I hate to say it, but Queen Victoria was right.
I can't leave the subject of arsenic without getting you to tell us the story of this woman, Tofana of Sicily.
Oh, yes. Well, she developed a... Well, it was sold under a sort of tonic-cum-cosmetic benefit, Aqua Tofana. And what you did, you bought this solution, and ideally you either drank a little of it or you washed your face with it, and you would have a beautiful complexion. But, of course, what she was selling was a solution of arsenic oxide, white arsenic in water. And very quickly people realised, of course, you could get rid of people with this. And it became known as, it was called as Aqua Tofana. But something like 500 murders were eventually attributed to this. And it was, often you could buy it in powder form as well. And it was known as poudre de succession, you know, the succession powder. It was supposed to be the way that would-be heirs to various estates and claims got rid of their fathers or their parents in order to succeed. And we know that some of this was true because, you know, quite famous murders were committed with it. And eventually, of course, they caught her, and I think they either hanged her, they executed her anyway.
Science writer John Emsley. His book is The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Reproduction is the Flaw of Love, a comic novel about a man facing up to his fear of commitment by Lauren Grodstein. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a slow, painful death. More on the history of poison with chemist John Emsley. He tells us about the perpetual pill, a reusable cure for constipation in the Middle Ages, which turned out to be a tiny ball of the deadly element antimony. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about a Philadelphia record label that generated some major golden oldies. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, John Emsley, is a chemist and science writer. He chronicles centuries of intentional and accidental poisoning in his new book, The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. The element antimony has poisonous properties, but was used for centuries as a medicine. And you tell us was credited with actually saving the life of the young King Louis XIV of France.
Oh, yes. This is, again, it's like a lot of these poisons. People originally thought they could use them for human benefit as medicines. And there is one particular compound of antimony, potassium antimony tartrate, known as tartarimetic. And the name, of course, came from the fact that if you took a small amount of this, within about 10 minutes, the stomach suffers a massive reaction to it and you start vomiting. So you can empty your stomach very quickly. And it was something that people used to take, they got a hangover, a morning after a cure, you know, when you feel pretty rotten and you took some of this, you had a good throw up and then you were supposed to feel better. But whenever, it also was at a certain capacity of lowering the body temperature. Now, with some diseases like typhoid and cholera and various fevers that, again, we don't know quite what these fevers were that people in those days suffered from, if you took tartarimetic, it did, in doses lower than the amount to make you vomit, then it did tend to bring the body temperature down. And, of course, that could be quite important in dealing with the disease. And this is what happened to King Louis XIV. He was suffering. We're not quite sure what he was suffering from, but it might have been a cholera or something like that. And he was given this treatment, which was basically against the law in France in those days. This was a treatment that people knew could be dangerous, but nevertheless, I suppose they felt rather desperate in case of the king. And it worked for him. And very quickly he had the law repealed, and tartarimetic then became part of the pharmacies of France. And something like for the next 200 years, people often took tartarimetic as we would take aspirin today. It was, you know, quite a common thing around the house. Funnily enough, there were even something called emetic cups. They were made of antimony metal, and you put a little bit of wine into them at the beginning of the evening. You went out, of course, on the tiles. You came back. You'd had too much to drink the following morning. You drank the wine that you put into the cup, and by then it had dissolved enough antimony from the cup to actually act as an emetic. Then, of course, you were supposed to feel better after you'd thrown up.
You have to tell us the story of the perpetual pill.
Well, yes, and I got this story from Oliver Sacks, the famous neurologist. And he did tell me that in his family there was a perpetual pill that was passed down from generation to generation. And, of course, the perpetual pill was it's rather like a ball bearing made of antimony. And you swallowed this, and, of course, once it was in the gut sensed it didn't want this and began to work very rapidly to get rid of it. So it acted a very good laxative. The end of that, of course, you then retrieved the pill, washed it and used it again. Hence the name perpetual pill.
It took a little nerve to take, I suspect, but...
I suppose if you carefully cleaned it and boiled it or something, then there would be no harm from passing bacteria from one person to another. But he generally said, I've looked it up, and there were such things as sold as perpetual pills for this very reason, that they were very good laxatives.
One of the most notorious poisoners of the 19th century was Dr. Edward Palmer, whose case inspired legislation in Parliament and I think earned him a place in Madame Tussauds' wax museum.
Oh, for something like 100 years, I think, yeah.
What made Palmer's case so unusual?
Well, can I be rather crude?
Please.
He couldn't keep his trousers zipped up. No, they didn't have zipped. And, of course, he got lots of young girls around the countryside where he lived in Staffordshire, pregnant. And, of course, they produced these illegitimate babies. And the theory was, of course, he had a jar of poisoned honey and he used to dip his finger in that and let the baby suck it, and that got rid of the problem. Now, it's not known how many people he poisoned, but we certainly knew that he poisoned a few of his betting companions. He was an avid racegoer and very often bet heavily and very often lost. And the people he lost to very often suffered mysterious deaths. And we know from one of these that, in fact, he did poison him with antimony. And, of course, he tended also to get money by insuring relatives and then poisoning them and collecting the insurance. And eventually the insurance companies cottoned on to what he was doing and wouldn't allow him to insure people. But in those days, you could actually insure people without their knowledge. And this is where the law was changed. So
I could have evil designs on a friend without him knowing, take out an insurance policy on his life, off him, and then collect the money?
That was possible in those days, yes. And he did this with his mother-in-law. And the thing is, you know, that eventually it was quite an obvious law to pass that you could not insure somebody's life without that person knowing about it, because obviously it was a temptation to people like William Palmer to insure them, murder them, and collect the money. But he was a notorious poisoner, yeah.
My guest is John Emsley. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. We're speaking with John Emsley. He is a popular science writer and chemist and the author of The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. You know, it's striking in this book how many of the poisonous murderers you profile are serial killers. Is there something about a poisoning murder that makes it more likely to be repeated?
I think because you tend to get away with it. You tend to think you've hit on the perfect way of doing away with people that you don't want. And so the temptation then is to go on and on doing it. And of course, in Victorian times, when you get some of these serial killers, especially women who used arsenic, they got rid of babies, they got rid of all sorts of relatives, inconvenient relatives. And of course, the doctor simply put down, you know, gastric flu or cholera or something like this as the cause of death. And often if they moved around, you know, their victims were being examined by not the same doctor who might have eventually put two and two together, different doctors. And so they got away with, you know, sometimes 20, 30, 40 murders before they were finally caught.
You write a lot about lead. In the Roman Empire, it appears that wealthy Romans were regularly poisoning themselves with this sweetening agent for wine. Sapa, is that how it's what?
That's right, it's sapa. Well, in those days, of course, sugar hadn't yet reached Europe. Sugar, it started in Indonesia. And in Roman times, of course, the only natural sweetening agent was honey. And, of course, if you didn't have honey, then you needed an artificial sweetening agent. And the Romans had discovered this compound called sapa. And they made it by boiling down sour wine in lead pans. And you boiled it down and eventually ended up with this very sweet syrup. Now, we now know that syrup was lead acetate, and it's possible to grow crystals rather like sugar from it. And in, you know, Victorian times, you could actually buy sugar of lead. And its name gives it away. It was very sweet. And, of course, the upper-class Romans could afford this. And, of course, their desserts, there are recipe books still extant from Roman times. And, of course, sapa is mentioned in a lot of them. About a quarter of the recipes would include sapa as an ingredient for sweet desserts.
And how did it affect them?
Well, of course, the thing about this is, of course, if you take a lot of lead into it, it breaks down the metabolism that's trying to make new blood. So people became anemic, they became infertile. This was always a puzzle as to why the upper classes in Roman times had so few children. We now know because they were making themselves infertile with this particular sweetening agent. And it was quite worrying. I mean, there have been books which suggested that this agent undermined the Roman Empire. Now, again, there are so many factors as to why the Roman Empire came to an end. I don't think the sweetening agent, it might have contributed to a little, but not. It wasn't the major factor. The major factor, of course, was invasion from outside. But, of course, if you're slowly poisoning the best people in society with this agent, then, of course, you aren't going to benefit society at large.
And people in the British Empire also.
I thought you might not come on to that. But the British were very fond of port wine. I mean, we'd had several wars with France, and of course it was slightly unpatriotic to buy French brandy. But we'd always been on good terms with Portugal, and it was very, very patriotic to buy lots of port wine. The thing was, to preserve port wine, you put a pellet of lead shot into every bottle, and this would slowly dissolve. Now, it would help to sweeten the wine, it would help to preserve it as well. But, of course, people who drank port wine very often the symptom that they displayed most of was what's called saturnine gout. And saturnine means lead, lead-based gout. And, of course, this incapacitated lots of people in sort of the age of the British Empire. But, of course, we were using lead pipes, we were using lead pewter, children were playing with lead toys. You took lead, it was sometimes used to prevent diarrhea because it paralyzes the gut.
It's now believed that Beethoven suffered from lead poisoning. How do we know this?
Well, they've analysed his hair, I think it is, because the provenance of a sample of his hair is extremely good, and I explain this in the book. It was cut from his hair by a young musician the day after he died, and it was preserved in a little glass case, and it was put on display on a wall. And the family who got it, we know how they passed it down, until eventually they ended up in Denmark in the Second World War. Now, the Danish government knew that the Germans were getting, you know, eliminating Jews in the Holocaust, and they warned the Jewish population in Denmark that they were likely to be targeted, and they gave them the opportunity to escape across the sea to Sweden. But of course, you more or less had to buy your way onto the boats that were taking you. And one man offered this sample of Beethoven's hair as his passage across to safety in Sweden. And that family then put it on auction 20 years later in London. And, of course, suddenly people realised this was, and it was an authentic sample of his hair, when it was analysed, there was a high level of lead. And it's almost certain that perhaps Beethoven, because he was a heavy drinker, poisoned himself slowly with lead, and because he had all the symptoms of lead poisoning, chronic lead poisoning, not severe lead poisoning.
Clarify for us, what symptoms Beethoven suffered and where he might have gotten his lead poisoning?
Well, the thing is, there are lots of ways he could have got his lead poisoning. What lead poisoning does, it gives you terrible stomach ache, colic, lead colic it's called. It gives you chronic constipation. You never seem to be able to go to the toilet properly. You tend also, it begins to affect your brain and your nervous system. And of course, one of the symptoms of that is you go slowly deaf. Another symptom, of course, is that you then go slowly mad as well. So there are lots of well-recognized symptoms of lead poisoning, mainly because it's interfering with your body trying to make hemoglobin. And your body can't make hemoglobin because lead is tying up the enzyme that's trying to make this for you. The result is that the raw materials that hemoglobin is made of build up in the body, and they produce the symptoms that are the unpleasant symptoms, because your body can't get rid of it. It doesn't know what to do with it. You get intense stomach aches, you get constipation, you get your nervous system is paralyzed. And all these, of course, the more lead you have, the worse these things get. And your body has great difficulty removing lead. It's not an easy thing for it to remove. It tends to want to take it to your skeleton and store it there to get it out of the way. Mm. And so you can see how chronically you would be poisoned with lead without realizing it. You wouldn't be able to put your finger, like Beethoven couldn't. He was aware he was being affected. He was very irritable a lot of the time. He was always argumentative. He slowly was going deaf. And thankfully, it didn't affect his creative powers. They sailed through unaffected. But the people around him, of course, found him very difficult to live with.
Now the British king, George III, the one who lost the colonies, was known to have suffered periodic fits of madness. I mean, even
yes.
attacking his son at dinner, you tell us at one time. Now, what's the case that he may have suffered from lead poisoning?
Well, the thing is, again, he had all the classic symptoms of lead poisoning. They saw him as going mad, and of course they treated him for his madness. In other words, they kept him strapped to a chair so he couldn't, and gagged so he couldn't say. He was rambling all the time and accusing people of all sorts of things. And slowly, of course, they were able to treat him, and the body will shed lead slowly, and of course he then became sane. I don't think he was ever insane. He was just being seriously affected mentally by lead. Now, why should he be affected by lead and not the other members of the royal family? Well, I think I've been able to explain that, because he was very fond of sauerkraut. Now, sauerkraut was not a popular dish in Britain. People in Britain didn't use it. But, of course, he came from Germany. He was from the German royal family. And, of course, he liked sauerkraut. He had it imported, especially for his use. And we know that the peasants of Germany who make sauerkraut, towards the end of the winter, when you have to fall back on sauerkraut for your main vegetable, a lot of them went down with lead poisoning, because the sauerkraut can leach lead from the lead glaze of the pots in which they stored it. Now, I suspect that this may have also affected George III. And of course, he might have been one of these people particularly susceptible to lead poisoning. If you've got not enough of the enzymes that you need to make heme for hemoglobin, and you poison those enzymes with a tiny amount of lead, you're going to have a disproportionately bad effect from them. Now, I can't prove this, of course. We'd have to take samples of his body, and I don't suppose they would have given permission for that. But it looks to me, rather than suggest that he was mad because perhaps of some genetic disorder, I think we could look and say, well, yes, perhaps he was mad simply because he overexposed himself to lead.
Is there a time in history when homicides by poison were most prevalent?
Yes, I think almost certainly in Europe, perhaps in Italy and France. There were very corrupt times in the Middle Ages. I mean, you know, all sorts of people died mysterious deaths, and we now know people like Tufano were active in those times, supplying people with poisons. It became part of the political scene to get rid of opponents using poison. Thankfully, all that's come to a... Well, we thought it had come to an end, but then Saddam Hussein used to send out his agents with poisons, and they were using thallium to get rid of people he didn't want. But again, you see, it was very quickly recognised that they were poisoned with thallium. I mean, it didn't save them always, but often it did.
And recently there was the poisoning in the Ukraine of President Viktor Yushchenko.
Right. Yes. Now, you see, that I think that was a very subtle poisoning, because they gave him a dioxin, they gave him... And it wouldn't be difficult to do, gave him the most toxic dioxin. There are lots of dioxins, some of which don't have any effect, but there is one in particular which causes a disease called chloracne, and that is a severe form of acne. And when you look at his face, you can see, in fact, he's suffered from this because his whole face was at one time covered with pustules. And even when I saw him on television last week, you can still see that large patches of his face are still being affected by this disease. And you can link that directly with dioxin because it was known as an industrial disease 100 years ago. People who worked with compounds that contained this often went down with chloracne. And again, it's a very subtle poison if you think about it, Dave, because, you know, today your image on television is very important for a politician. And so if you can screw someone's image up, as they did with him, then there's a good chance, of course, people will shy away from watching him and then they would shy away from getting his message.
Wow,
thankfully, this was exposed and I think actually worked to his benefit.
John Inslee, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. It's been a delightful session.
Science writer John Emsley. His new book is The Elements of Murder, A History of Poison. That's the Klaas Brothers and Cuba Percussion doing their version of Beethoven's Fifth on the album Classic Meets Cuba. Coming up, a forgotten Philadelphia record label that turned out some memorable hits in the 50s and 60s. This is Fresh Air. Conventional rock history had it that the early 60s were its dark ages, although thanks to Motown, the Beach Boys, and much else, we now know that wasn't completely true. But rock historian Ed Ward says there were many horrible records on the charts in those days, and a lot of them were made in Philadelphia by the Cameo and Parkway labels. Ed has this review of the legacy of Cameo Parkway, now collected on a four-disc set.
For years, it's been a long-held belief that sometime in the late 1950s, Philadelphia destroyed rock and roll. Since the city has given so much to American music, from its great symphony orchestra to John Coltrane to the soulful Philadelphia International label, this seems unlikely. But now that I have a four-disc overview of Cameo Parkway Records in my hands, I'm afraid the evidence is in. Cameo Parkway was started in late 1956 by Bernie Lowe, a pianist, and Cal Mann, a lyricist, after they'd made a bunch of money with a song, Teddy Bear, that Elvis Presley had made into a hit. Soon, they added a third partner, Dave Apple, who was an all-round musician, engineer, and talent scout. Apple was younger than the middle-aged Lowe and Mann, but the three shared a common lack of taste and canny business sense. Rock and roll was junk, their credo seemed to be, and if you just toss together the right ingredients, the kids will buy it.
Lucky fella,
two,
love you true, and I got
three
little words I'm saving
for
only you. 5 o'clock I call ya, and by
six
we got a date. Seven I'll be heaven bound, and in your arms about
eight.
Everybody now,
we got love.
The number. Ooh, yeah.
Bobby Rydell was typical, a cute kid with good hair and a singing voice better than that of his fellow Philadelphian Fabian, and he could put across a Low Man composition like We Got Love with enough conviction to put it into the top 10 in 1959. The label put out a lot of this kind of thing when they weren't doing stupid follow-up records or novelties. Then they got lucky, real lucky. With Chubby Checker singing Hank Ballard's original tune note for note, and Dave Apple's band taking the bite out of the original backing, and with the help of Dick Clark, whose Philly-based TV show American Bandstand was always there to help Cameo Parkway acts, the tune rocketed to the top of the charts not once, but twice, the only time a record's ever done this, once in 1960 and again in 1962. This gave the label the means to unleash a torrent of recorded dreck onto America's airwaves, but it has to be admitted that once in a very rare while, they got something right.
The kids in Bristol are sharp as a pistol when they do the Bristol stomp. Really something when the joint is jumping when they do.
Dovells were five kids from West Philly, whose moment of glory just missed out on the top chart slot in 1961. And then there were the Orlons. South Street, which climbed the charts early in 1963, was pretty much the last gasp for the old regime at Cameo Parkway. But the same doom was awaiting many of this era's pop schlockmeisters, the Beatles. Bernie Lowe left the company in 1964, having made a bunch of money, but depressed by the success of Motown and the pressures of running the business. In 1965, the label was bought by a pair of Texans, and the headquarters was moved to New York, where a 23-year-old named Neil Bogart was basically running things. Bogart had ears, and he was smart. He also must have had connections in Detroit, because a lot of the new stuff that came out on the label was from there. And it was good. One record from this era, never a national hit, wound up making history. Rationals were big around Detroit, so their version of this Otis Redding song got a lot of local airplay. Another Detroiter, Aretha Franklin, heard it on the radio one day and decided she'd give it a shot. And she did. But Bogart was getting restless and would soon start Buddha Records and later Casablanca, the disco powerhouse. American tastes were, thank heavens, changing. Alan Klein took Cameo Parkway over in 1967 and killed it. Not a moment too soon.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. He reviewed the four-disc retrospective of Cameo Parkway Records.
Too many teardrops for one heart to be crying. Too many teardrops for one heart to carry on.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
But watch out now. I'm gonna get there. We'll be together. Just a little while, and then I'm gonna put you way down here, and you'll start crying 96 tears.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from V2 Records, presenting the White Stripes' new CD, Get Behind Me, Satan, available at Barnes & Noble and barnesandnoble.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the dark side of the world economy. Writer William Britton Catlin says offshore banking shelters a third of the world's wealth in secret accounts that keep profits away from the eyes of tax collectors and government regulators. Britton Catlin opens the vault of secrecy in his new book, Offshore. Join us for the next Fresh Air.